Give me just a second to get the controls going here. We're talking about one of my favorite subjects this evening, and I think you can see that a lot better if I turn the projector on. I thought that was on. We're working with the sound system. We'll have a clip in a moment that has a little chirp in it. If you'll just ignore the chirp, I don't know where it's coming from. We'll, I think, still be able to benefit from it. The fossil record intimidates a lot of Christians. That's supposed to prove evolution. We hear that often, and people will say, how can you believe in creation we have the fossil record that proves evolution? Anybody ever heard that? I hope after this evening you won't believe that. You'll know that that's just not true. The fossils belong to the creationist. They're our strongest evidence, and they are the strongest evidence, I believe, against evolution. From time to time, I have the opportunity to debate the subject, and this is the subject I want to debate. This is the subject I choose. We had a debate not too long ago at LSU, scheduled for over 6 months with the head of the Department of Geology. We got there, the auditorium was full, hundreds of students, chairs in the aisles, and the professor didn't show, which is not unusual. They just have realized the debates are not helping them, and they've stopped. So I won. We spoke for about an hour, and then had Q&A for another hour. They did do a survey as the students were coming in. 53% were creationists. I think they were more interested in the evidence. The campus organization that put it on did a follow-up 2 weeks later, and 93% at that point were creationists, which is why they don't like to debate, you know. But it doesn't help him not to show up either. Let's notice a statement by S.M. Stanley of Johns Hopkins University, who's talking about the nature of the fossils relative to this issue of creation and evolution. He says it's doubtful whether, in the absence of fossils, the idea of evolution would be represent anything more than an outrageous hypothesis. It's an amazing statement, because I don't think he has the fossils. But without it, as we'd say in Texas, they're just up the creek. It's an outrageous hypothesis. The fossil record, and only the fossil record, provides direct evidence of major sequential changes in the Earth's biota. There are a lot of lines of evidence that would provide circumstantial evidence and implications, but when you get to proof of what happened in the past, this is where it's at. This would have to be where they prove, if they can prove. Well, let's see what the evidence is. But how do you look at the fossil record and distinguish between the implications for creation or evolution? What would the evolutionist predict, and what would the creationist predict? And that's one of the ways you test models, by making predictions and then see how the facts line up. Well, as we think about the implications, the predictions of both models, we would, as we look at the beginning, see the most critical area. A simple, gradual, linked progression is what the evolutionist would predict. On the other hand, a sudden, complex, abrupt beginning would be predicted by the creationist. Now, that's different, isn't it? And we should be able to look at the record and tell which is served best. From there, we would expect this continuum, this allied progression of things that are kin, gradually progressing upward, whereas the creationist would say, no, they're separate and distinct, and stasis, that is, the lack of change, would be the order that we would predict. Now, I think both of them would predict similarities, but for different reasons, and they would be different types of similarities. The evolutionist would predict this branching pattern of similarities because of the developing kinships, whereas the creationist would say, well, yes, it would not be unusual for a common designer to use similar forms for similar functions, but they would not be connected or allied in a gradual continuum. It would be more the mosaic pattern, like the artist who uses a blue tile here where he needs it and then uses a blue tile again over here, not connected, but there because that's where it's needed. And so I think even looking at similarities, which we both predict, we can see a difference and would make predictions that would allow us to distinguish the difference. Now, how do we tell what the nature of the evidence is? I would say, here's the nature of the evidence, sudden complex beginning, mosaic pattern. But somehow we don't get to say that. And so in order to be credible, we have to have the evolutionist describe the nature of the fossil record, and we will allow that to happen this evening. We want to hear what the antagonistic witness says. Now, sometimes people misunderstand this concept, and they're just a little dense sometimes. They don't get it. I'm not implying these people agree with me, and it's not unfair to quote somebody who doesn't agree with me if I quote them accurately and represent them correctly. It's the evidence from the antagonistic witness that is actually more powerful or stronger, and certainly this is the case when we are in court. You may get a friend to testify on your behalf in court and say the accused is honest, there's no reasonable motive, and that'll help your friend testifying for you, but he's your friend. But if you can get the antagonistic witness, the fellow on the other side, to admit that, then that's much stronger evidence. Judicially, that's 10 times the weight, I'm told. And so when we look at friendly testimony, okay, that helps, but when you get what we call acknowledgments contrary to interest, which is what we have when we look at the evolutionist acknowledgments that fit the creationist predictions, then you have much weightier evidence. So let's not misunderstand. The quotations that we'll be using this evening, with a few exceptions which I will make very clear, are all evolutionist. These are devout believers in evolution. I think they're men of great faith, but I'm talking about faith in evolution. Now, we'll begin, for example, with Richard Dawkins, and you can't find a man of greater faith in evolution than this. He's a vicious anti-creationist. Let's let him describe the beginning of the fossil record, this most critical area of evidence. What's it like at the beginning, right down at the bottom, as they define the bottom of the geologic column? He says, we find many of them already in an advanced state of evolution the first time they appear. That's an amazing statement. Now, you just think about it. It's a state of evolution, but it just starts. And where's the evidence for evolution? There's nothing, and then there it is. Well, but that's evolution. That's a man of great faith, you see. It's as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history, but he has great faith that it was there, but it's not in evidence. Already advanced without evolutionary history. Needless to say, this appearance of sudden planting has delighted the creationist. And I'll plead guilty. This is what we predict, and that's what we find according to the antagonistic witness. Just exactly what we predict. You have articles like this in National Geographic, which is very antagonistic, and you need to understand that when you look through its pages, describing the beginning of this first layer, as they define it. They describe it as an explosion of life, not this gradual beginning from the simple graduated up to the more complex. Mr. Maltz, University of Texas at Austin, Dr. Maltz, is one of the leading lights in biology today, and he refers to the Cambrian explosion in the MSNBC publication. He says it wasn't a gradual development of complexity. Now, isn't that an amazing statement? That's what you should find. That's what the evolutionist predicts. But it wasn't. Instead, these things suddenly seem to burst out of a magic box. No, he's not a creationist. These are men of great faith in evolution. Perhaps the leading light, most often quoted evolutionist in our country is the late Stephen J. Gould, writing in Nature. And he refers to this Cambrian explosion, the Cambrian being that bottom layer where its multicellular animals began. It occurred at a geological moment, and we have reason to think that all major anatomical designs may have made their evolutionary appearance at that time. That's an evolutionary appearance, just trust me, you know, believe. But boom, there it is, and you've got them all the anatomical designs, in a moment, in an explosion, but it's an evolutionary appearance. Can you believe that? An amazing demonstration of faith. Not only the phylum Chordata, that's the biological category that we belong to, the animals with backbones, the highest order, not only the phylum Chordata itself, but all its major divisions, right at the bottom, right at the start, it's an explosion. Now, if I were trying to make this up and write the story to fit my view, I couldn't do a better job than that. But believe me, he does not believe in creation. He says, since the so-called Cambrian explosion, no new phyla of animals have entered the record. You've got not only all of the major anatomical designs, all of the classes and orders right at the start, but no new ones since. Now, can you figure out which model is being served best? By their beginning description, their description of the beginning at the critical part of this record. Summarizing, down at the bottom, as they define it, it's as if they burst out of a magic box. They're complex, they appear suddenly right at the start. They're advanced, just planted without any evolutionary history. You have all the major anatomical designs, the chordata, all of its major divisions, and since then, you got nothing. No major phyla. According to the evolutionist, the antagonistic witness. Okay, let's go home. that just is overwhelming, and that's, of course, their description of it. Yet, when you look in the biology textbook, you see this. Not all of the major divisions at the beginning, but this single-celled organism with all the major divisions at the top. If you turn that thing upside down, it would be closer to what you see in the fossil record. This is not anything to do with the fossil record. This is the theory illustrated in the biology textbooks as to what they would expect, but that's not what you find. In fact, Stephen Gould, the leading evolutionist, says the evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of the fossils. So when you see these trees, evolutionary trees of life, that is not from the fossil record. It's pretty well opposite to the fossil record, according to the evolutionist. In his book, Wonderful Life, he describes the cone of diversity, which is, of course, the prediction of the evolutionist, this gradual, slow development from the simple beginning. He says that's not what you see. He says it's the other way around. You see virtually everything from the start. We see a decline through time. The beginning at the top declines through time. He says it turned the traditional interpretation on its head. They have inverted the cone. That is, paleontologists, as we've studied the fossil record, have inverted the prediction. But the prediction, of course, is still there, alive and well, and touted as reality in the textbooks. showing just exactly the opposite of what the fossil record shows, according to the evolutionist. But now, where does this come from? How do we get this kind of arrangement in the textbooks? Well, let's let them describe it for us. Here from Evolution of the Earth, the standard geology textbook, we have arranged the groups in a traditional way with the simplest forms first. How do you get the simplest forms first? You arrange it that way. That's what he says. And progressively more complex groups following. This particular arrangement is arbitrary, and some will have different arrangements depending on their assumptions. Now, I don't want to misrepresent. It's not quite that bad. He has a way to arrange, a basic philosophy that allows him to stack it to arrange it. Remember last night we talked about the circular logic and beginning with the simplest animals on the bottom? That's what we see illustrated in the tree. We arranged it that way with the simplest forms first. But the reason they're doing this is this assumption. This is on the same page. Things are alike because they are related. The less they look alike, the further removed they are from their common ancestor. Now, that's the fundamental assumption that allows them to stack this. Not the fossil record, but the assumption of kinship based on similarities. And so we're going to have to spend some time talking about similarities when we talk about the fossil record. Otherwise, you just got dead things in rocks. To put them together, to make them say anything, or evolution, you certainly have to make an assumption like this. Well, we certainly see similarities. We won't get personal, but you can look around the room and you can see some similarities to some other type of creatures. And we look at the internal structure, and can you deny similarity here? That's very obvious. You can see some dissimilarities, but they're more similar than dissimilar, it would appear. The question is not whether, but why are they similar? Is there only one explanation? The evolutionist will only consider one. That's all they look at. They have blinders in the other direction. You go down the street, you see similarities with architecture and the homes, and that's all because they're cousins, right? No, they've got a common designer, and you immediately infer that as you look at the similarities in the subdivision. Not common genetics, but a common designer would explain that similarity. And when you look at the living world, yes, you see obvious similarities. The question is why? Again, the evolutionist only looks at one explanation. They just don't allow any other possibility. But you can explain that by common genetics or common designer. A designer creating a similar form for a similar function. When you have these great artists, the music composers, the variation on the theme is the mark of the great composers. This is not evidence that it just happened all by itself. But we would expect that. And so we explain at least as well. However, we see some real advantages when you look more closely at facts that they don't tell you about until you get into grad school. Common genetics it just can't explain this. There's a challenge when you look at the genetics, especially when you study embryology, the development of these forms. The hand, which we see here, the pendactyl form of the vertebrate hand, is similar, but they develop from different parts of the embryo, indicating different genetics. The embryo, just crudely illustrated here, of the newt, the hand develops from embryonic segments 2 through 5. In man, the hand develops from embryonic segments 13 through 18, and the lizard from segments 6 through 9. Totally different parts of the embryo, which you wouldn't expect if common genetics is the explanation for the similarity. Just the hand here comes from this part of the embryo, crudely illustrated. They come from totally different parts of the embryo, and so common genetics is not really a good explanation for this. And it's not just that we can explain it as well. I think we have a distinct advantage when we look at these similarities. How many of you heard about the similarity between the apes and men, and that there's just 1% difference in the genome, the DNA, between apes and men? Well, that was a conclusion that was touted back in 1975, and we've learned so much since then, it is grossly outdated, and the latest information makes it look silly. And let me document that from some later journals. Here from Science, 2007. I mean, they've known it for a while, but they still are still teaching that. He says the relative difference, the title here, relative, the myth of the 1% difference. Studies are showing that human and chimps are not as similar as many tend to believe. They're missing the chunks of missing DNA, extra genes, altered connections. The very structure of chromosomes confound any quantification of humanness versus chimpness. It's so different, you can't even really compare it. It confounds any quantification. A Nature article here from 2010 says, regarding the comparison, now reveals they differ radically. That doesn't sound like 1%, does it? In sequence, structure, and gene content. For example, they point out that the chimp genome is 10 to 15% longer, but there's only 1% difference. 50% of the human genes were missing from the chimp genes. You didn't know that, did you? They don't tell you that. If 50% are missing, how do you say it's just 1% difference? You're not telling the truth if you're aware of what we've learned. 1/3 more gene categories, entirely different classes of genes, all documented here in Nature 2010. And so when they tell you 1% difference, it's just not so. It was from a long time ago when we didn't know that much about it. And as we learn more about it, we see and we expect similarities. They don't often tell you that when you look at sea sponges, you find that there appears to be a 70% correspondence in the genes of humans and men. Do you know you were that similar to the sponge? That may explain a lot of things. I don't know. SpongeBob takes on a different meaning there. But when you look at the genome, you see things that you just don't expect as an evolutionist. You have a 6-foot man with 60 trillion cells, and you compare that with this 1 millimeter worm, 1,000 cells, 60 trillion, 1,000. Okay, that there ought to be a big difference in the genome, right? Exactly the same number of genes. Wow, that's not what you expect. Now, flies and chickens have 1/3 of what this worm does that we also have. On the other hand, rice and soybeans have twice as much genetic material as the human. How does this fit the evolutionary picture? It does not fit at all, but they don't normally tell you. When we look at similarities, we need to understand a lot of times there are similarities that are totally ignored. We look at these two fish and they appear to be similar, right? I see some nodding heads and I caught you. Because they're not similar. They're similar, obviously, but they're not fish. This one is a reptile and this one is a mammal. They both look like fish, but neither are. They're all similar, but not kin. There's an old adage, that which proves too much proves nothing. You only look at certain similarities if you're an evolutionist. You don't look at these similarities. Look the other way and don't see that. When you look at the whole picture, you have a totally different scenario. You look, for example, at blood serum, and we're often shown the chimpanzee, which has very similar blood serum. In fact, if the right antiserum is used, you can actually utilize the chimpanzee blood serum. Humans can. But If you look at milk chemistry, you have a different picture. The donkey has much, in fact, almost exactly the same chemistry as human milk. Not the ape, but the donkey. Now, you may say that I know some that that would fit pretty well with, but that's not the picture of the evolutionist. In terms of cholesterol, which we are all concerned about today, we find that in the living world, not everywhere, but guess which critter has cholesterol just like we do? The garter snake. Cousin. Not the ape. Much closer than the ape. When we consider foot structure, which we're interested in when we study the footprints down at Glen Rose, people will say, well, maybe it's an ape. Which wouldn't help the evolutionary picture at all. They're supposed to have evolved much later than the dinosaurs as well. But the ape has a hand for a foot, doesn't he? Doesn't look like our foot at all. But the glacial bear has a hand almost identical to ours if you remove the claws and if you put it in a mirror. The thumbs are reversed. It's a mirror image. But when you remove the fur and the skin and the claws and put it in the mirror, wow, there's our hand. Just like, it's striking. Not the ape. When you look at tear enzyme, which is a very complex protein, and it's designed, I think, to eat bacteria. Like little Pac-Man running around just, and we need that in the eye, which might get infected if we in this opening if we don't have protection there. Where else do we find that? The chicken needs that in the egg. And he has this very complex enzyme, lysosome, just like the humans do, that's designed to eat bacteria, protect. Here's that blue tile here and the blue tile there, the mosaic pattern of similarity. And then when we consider blood antigen A, lo and behold, our closest relative is the butterbean. Blood antigen A in the butterbean. And of course, we know that we have very sophisticated brains. Where in the living world do we find similar brain hormones? Of all places, in the cockroach, has brain hormone just like ours. Notice the article from Discover. Don't squash that roach. He may be your cousin. They share a common brain hormone. Now, that's not a simple organism, the hormone. It's an extremely complex, specifically ordered sequence, and the cockroaches got it. Maybe that explains some things that we hadn't thought about. But when we look at man's relatives and look at the whole picture, where's the ape? Some places it's the cockroach, other places it's the bat. It's the mosaic pattern. It is not this graduated nesting table indication that is predicted by the evolutionist. This is a mosaic pattern of similarities. So, when we consider the fossil evidence, the beginning, the critical area, according to the evolutionist, it's complex and abrupt and diverse right from the start, and no new phyla, major division since then. These trees that adorn our textbooks are from selected similarities, ignoring many similarities. They're not from the fossils. Upside down from the fossils. They're not from embryology, and they're not from genetics. They're from philosophy. The similarities that we do see show the mosaic pattern when you look at all of the evidence, not the branching pattern that the evolutionist would predict. Now, if you're going to show that one thing evolved from another, how would you do that? Well, you would have to have transitional forms in the fossil record, wouldn't you? And Darwin recognized that, and this is a critical part of the evidence. He says innumerable transitional forms must have existed. In fact, he said you'd have many more transitional forms than you would have the regular forms, because that's how we got here. They must have existed, but why do we not find them in countless numbers in the crust of the earth. Why is not every geological formation, every stratum, full of such intermediate links? He says, geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, and this is perhaps the greatest objection which can be urged against my theory. Many people think that the fossil record is what convinced Darwin. Is that what he's saying? This is the biggest problem he's got. It's saying the opposite of what he expects. It ought to be there. This is predicted. This is the way you test models. You make predictions, and he made the prediction, and it failed. His answer that he gives to this in his text is, well, yes, that's the way it is now, but as we collect more fossils, it'll get better. Did it? Has it? No. Niles Eldridge, one of the leading evolutionists in our country, who's curator of the American Museum of Natural History, the largest fossil museum in the United States, over 32 million fossil specimens. He's the curator there. I think he'd know a little bit about the fossil record. He refers to Darwin's prediction that these gaps would be filled in. We'd find the intermediate forms. Darwin prophesied that future generations of paleontologists would fill in these gaps by diligent search. It has become abundantly clear that the fossil record will not confirm this part of Darwin's prediction. The more we looked, the more pronounced the gaps became, and separate and distinct right from the start. And in the handout that you will have available for you, there's much more documentation than we have time to give you tonight. We're condensing 4 one-hour lectures into supposedly about 50 minutes. We'll see. Nor, he says, is the problem a miserably poor record. Of course, this is what Darwin says. We've got a poor record. We'll fix it as we find more. No, that's not the problem. The record simply shows that this prediction was wrong. Now, that's not a creationist, though he may sound like one. He is the leading evolutionist in the country, one of them. Derek Eger was president of the British Geological Association when this statement was made, and he's talking about the same kind of a problem. He says, it must be significant that nearly all the evolutionary stories I heard as a student have now been debunked. And he refers to some specifically. He was taught this is a missing form, but then you learn more about it and it doesn't work. One of the stories he's talking about is the horse story. Anybody ever seen this in the textbooks? Basically, we got little horses and big horses. Most of them don't put Eohippus in this line anyway, though the textbooks do. It makes a prettier lineup. That's supposed to go to hippopotamus, according to most evolutionists, but for the most part, you got big horses and little horses, which we see today in the living world. Some of the things they leave out, we excavated a donkey out near Lubbock, Texas, that was 9 feet tall at the shoulder. Y'all have all seen donkeys like that? What would that do to this horse chart? Well, just leave that out. That messes it up, you see. You don't want to look at all of the evidence. But notice the statement by the leading authority in the field, George Gaylord Simpson of Harvard, who is the one who came up with this argument initially and helped develop it. In his book, Life of the Past, he says, the uniform continuous transformation of Hydrocotherium into Equius, that's the little one into the big one, so dear to the hearts of generations of textbook writers, and surely it is because it's in all of the textbooks, never happened in nature. Now, there is no higher authority in horse evolution than George Gaylord Simpson of Harvard. But he said, what you see in the textbooks never happened. Not a creationist, but that's what the leading expert says. Now, he believes that they evolved, but it was sort of a bushy, sort of imaginary, much more complex, very different from what you see in the textbooks. But that's one of the links that Eger is talking about when he says the stories I was taught in school have been debunked. Then we come to Archaeopteryx, probably the most often quoted or touted specimen for the link the transitional form between reptiles and birds, because he's just kind of half reptile and half bird, very reptilian and very bird-like all at the same time. We have some beautiful fossils. This is the Berlin specimen, Solnhofen limestone in Bavaria. And it looks very bird-like for the most part, and it has perfect feathers, just spectacularly preserved fossils of the feathers. And the structure of the wing is just like the powered birds that we see today. But we're told, look, out on the end of the wing you've got claws, therefore primitive. He lost them, or most birds lost them, and that's a downhill process. I'm continually amazed at critters that lost things that are supposed to be evolutionary examples. The cavefish loses his eyes. See, he's evolving. If I lost my eyes, I don't think I'd be evolving. We had a discussion. Actually, I was testifying before the textbook committee in Austin, Texas, with Dr. Bishop, who was head of the biology department at the University of Texas. And the textbook committee was questioning the two of us, and they said, Dr. Bishop, can you give us a good example of evolution? If we are supposed to teach this in the books, where's an example? He said, well, the cavefish in Texas gives us an excellent example. It adapted to its dark environment and lost its eyes. Dr. Patton, what do you say about that? Well, there's a tremendous amount of genetic material, just awesome, I would call it design, involved in the eye, and he lost it. That's a downhill process. I said, now if he comes up with a headlight down there, that would be evolution, but he's losing. And then one of the textbook committee members said, well, Dr. Bishop, can you come up with a better example than that salamander that went blind, or the fish that went blind? He got up and left. The tern is a powerful flyer. Over 3,000 miles it flies as it migrates each year. It used to have claws on its wings in the fossil record. They've lost it. We do find birds with claws today, and they're not primitive. They're perfectly good birds. This is the Hoatzin from down in South America. But we're told, look, he has teeth. That's obviously a primitive feature. You looked in the mirror lately. A primitive feature. Some of the hummingbirds still have teeth, more of them in the fossil record. They've kind of gone downhill there. But you look in the fossil record and you see some amphibians that have teeth and some that don't. And you see some reptiles that have teeth and some that don't. Some mammals have teeth, some don't. Probably some of you have teeth and some don't. What's the point here? This is not proving anything. This is a bird that had teeth. We have numbers of birds that have teeth today. He does have different teeth than the reptile that he's supposed to have led to. Had unserrated teeth and constricted bases and expanded roots like other Mesozoic birds, not like reptiles. But the real problem for the evolutionist with Archaeopteryx is that you have perfectly modern birds before, according to their dating system, Archaeopteryx. Here from nature, the fossil remains claim to be of two crow-sized birds 75 million years older than Archaeopteryx have been found. That's half again as old. It's hard to imagine having the kids older than the parents, you know. This doesn't work in the evolutionary picture. Paleontologists at Texas Tech University found the fossils, said they had advanced avian features or bird features. If the birds got there first, how's he going to lead to the birds? It's a story that falls apart. One after the other, as Ager says, has been debunked. We can summarize the picture, and you have many more examples in the handout that we'll give. D.B. Kitch, University of Oklahoma, a devout evolutionist, writing in the journal Evolution, says, the fact that discontinuities are almost always and systematically present at the origin of really big categories. Continuities are what are predicted. Discontinuities are what are found. If you've got something different, it's an obvious discontinuity. This is an item of genuinely historical knowledge. Evolution requires intermediate forms between species, and paleontology does not provide them. Not a creationist, but one of the leading paleontologists writing in the journal Evolution. It's not there. In fact, Stephen Stanley of Johns Hopkins University, often writing with Stephen Gould, says not one has been found. The fossil record does not convincingly document a single transition from one species to another. Now, he firmly believes they evolved, but you don't find it in the fossil record. The only documentary evidence that there is. Without the fossils, it's just an outrageous hypothesis, and there's not one. I was debating one of the professors down in Texas at Lamar University, and he was confronted with this, and he had a pretty good answer. Why, all fossils are transitional fossils. We know that because they evolved, and so they have to be transitional. But you don't have to show that one led to the other. Because they're here, they're transitional. Because we have great faith, they evolved. And you throw away looking at the evidence and trying to see transitions, and just, I believe that they're all transitional. And that's about as good a response as you can give. A.C. Stewart of Cambridge is talking about biology, but he says the theoretically primitive type eludes our grasp, our faith. Now, I'm sorry, botany. He says, our faith postulates its existence, but the type fails to materialize. And they do have great faith, but they don't see the evidence of it. As someone said regarding the faith of the evolutionist, it's the substance of fossils hoped for, the evidence of links unseen. But unlike the Christian who can defend his faith, this is a blind faith in spite of the fact that it's not there as acknowledged by the evolutionists themselves. That's not good faith. This is the evidence according to the evolutionist. It delights the creationist according to them. It embarrasses the evolutionist. And we'll see these quotes in the handout with the documentation. It was Darwin's biggest problem then. It's worse now. As we've learned more, the links are continually being debunked, but the blind faith still believes. Now, that's the nature of the fossil record, and because of those facts, which are certainly so, acknowledged even by the antagonistic witness, I'm persuaded that the fossil record favors creation. They belong to us, and I love to talk about the fossils. Now, we're scrunching this down so that we got two subjects tonight. Let's move quickly to the record of fossil men, which is exactly the same story. This is just the second stanza of the song. But we have the lineup that looks like a progression of primitive forms up to more complex forms, don't we? And most of it is dependent on the restorations that are drawn by the evolutionist. Ernst Hutton, when this statement was made, was head of the anthropology department at Harvard University. And many times we hear people say, well, now, we don't really believe that man came from apes. That's a misrepresentation. Well, here's head of the anthropology department at Harvard, and look at the title of his book, Up from the Apes. If we are descended from apes, our remote ancestors ought to look their part. You may not be willing to admit that you resemble an ape, but as you trace back the genealogical lines, you'll have to admit that somewhere in your family tree there squats an ape. Don't let them tell you that's not taught, because that little quibble is not so. Of course, they are not modern apes that we came from, but ancient apes that were definitely apes. But this one who certainly believes in evolution goes on to make a very objective and fair statement. He says, to attempt to restore the soft parts is an even more hazardous undertaking. Now, if you watch CSI or some of these programs, they can take a little bitty bone and tell you what the person looked like. They can tell you a lot about the bone structure. But what was the nose like? You can't tell, as he says. The lips, the eyes, the ears, the nasal tip leave no clues on the underlying bony parts. Head of the anthropology department at Harvard. Now, the bone structure can differentiate between various types of individuals, but the eyes, the ears, the nasal tip leave a very strong impression. And you can't tell that from the bones. You can, with equal facility, model on a Neanderthaloid skull the features of a chimpanzee or the lineaments of a philosopher. Now, most philosophers I know, you can tell the difference. Most. With a chimpanzee. Roger Lewin makes a very critical statement. And if you forget everything else, remember this tonight. He says the key issue, when you're talking about fossil man and anthropology, the key issue is the ability to correctly infer a genetic relationship between two species on the basis of similarity in appearance. How do you know this one's kin to that one? Well, they're kind of similar, you see, and you infer the relationship from similarity. We learned about similarity, and we know that's deceptive, as he goes on to say. Now, let's look at some of the examples. Lucy, for example, is the most famous of this first in the lineup that's supposed to have led to man. And we have some of this out of order here. Let's look at the rest of his statement. He says, this is deceptive, similarity is, partly because similarity of structure does not necessarily imply identical genetic heritage. A shark, which is a fish, a porpoise, which is a mammal, looks similar. Sound familiar? He says, this is deceptive, but that's the bottom line. That's the basis of the science of paleoanthropology. Well, they kind of look similar. Well, so does the shark and the porpoise, but they're not kin. You see, it's a deceptive basis, and it's not really proving anything. As Lamontin, who is one of the most devout evolutionists in the country and anti-creationist from Harvard, being interviewed here in Harper's right after he had testified viciously against the creationist, and I think maybe he was feeling embarrassed, he overstates his real objectivity here. He says, we don't know, and to be fair here, you have to really underscore no, we don't know anything about the ancestors of the human species. Now, he believes he knows. But no, you can't do that. All the fossils which have been dug up and are claimed to be ancestors, we haven't the faintest idea whether they're ancestors. It's up to you to draw the lines because there are no lines. Did you know that? When you dig them up, it's not a line going to this one that says, I'm kin to this one. You have to infer it from the similarity, and so we can't know. But they sure sound like it, don't they? This is the picture that's typically given in the textbooks. Very few of the experts believe this lineup, but that's what's taught. From Australopithecus to Homo erectus to Neanderthal to moderns. Considering Australopithecus, which is the first one in the lineup, we found the most famous one, Lucy, that we introduced out of order just a moment ago. And I'm going to allow a real expert in anatomy to testify regarding Lucy. Dr. David Minton was 30 years head of the Department of Anatomy at the University of Washington. He's one of the most often quoted authorities in the field. If you look in the medical textbook, you'll see he wrote a good bit of it. He is a creationist, unlike the others that we quote from. I told you with exceptions, I'd tell you. He is a creationist, which you'll be able to tell. But we've got about a 3-minute clip, and I want you to listen to what he has to say.
Picture, the creatures like Lucy have the ape orientation of the iliac blades. Now, what are the evolutionists going to do about that? You're not going to believe this. Nova, have you heard Nova? There was a PBS Nova series in which Dr. Owen Lovejoy, a very distinguished, famous paleoanthropologist, was involved. And he's looking at Lucy's skeleton here, and he's lamenting the fact that the hips are all wrong. They're supposed to be human-like hips so you can walk the way the Laetoli footprints showed she walked, but they don't look like human hips, they look like ape hips. What to do about this? Watch it, you'll get a big kick out of this.
The ape that stood up, it was a revolutionary idea. We needed Owen Lovejoy's expertise again, because the evidence wasn't quite adding up. The knee looked human, but the shape of her hip didn't. Superficially, her hip resembled a chimpanzee's, which meant that Lucy couldn't possibly have walked like a modern human. But Lovejoy noticed something odd about the way the bones had been fossilized.
When I put the two parts of the pelvis together that we had, this part of the pelvis has pressed so hard and so completely into this one that it caused it to be broken into a series of individual pieces which were then fused together in later fossils.
So you see, they were broken and they don't fit together properly. They did speculate in the program as to exactly who was responsible for breaking the hip, and current scientific evidence suggests perhaps a deer stepped on it. Here you can see a deer foot stepping on the bone. Isn't that a bummer? Let's see where it goes from here.
This has caused the two bones, in fact, to fit together so well they're in an anatomically impossible position.
The perfect fit was an illusion that made Lucy's hip bone seem to flare out like a chimp's. But all was not lost.
This is a power saw, friends. You may want to put your goggles on.
Lovejoy decided he could restore the pelvis to its natural shape. He didn't want to tamper with the original, so he made a copy in plaster.
Notice he's removing whole parts, not just cutting.
He cut the damaged pieces out and put them back together the way they were before Lucy died. It was a tricky job. But after taking the kink out of the pelvis, it all fit together perfectly, like a three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle.
Look how perfect! You can read a newspaper through the hole.
As a result, the angle of the hip looks nothing like a chimp's, but a lot like ours.
Yeah, now, this is what we call science. You can teach this in the public schools, but you can't criticize it, because if you do, that would be religious. So,
this Nova special, at least a dozen other specimens of this same creature, Australopithecus afarensis, has been found, and they've had to operate on all of the hips. They're all like the original that they changed. The new finds have that made that clip especially embarrassing. An interesting observation is made by Zillman regarding the pygmy chimps. You do find some that stand up upright somewhat, and the pygmy chimp does, not all the time, but a good bit of the time, does walk erect. And Zillman compares the pygmy chimpanzee to Lucy, one of the oldest hominid fossils known, and finds the similarities striking. They are almost identical in body size, in stature, in brain size. These commonalities, Zillman argues, indicate pygmy chimps use their limbs in much the same way Lucy did. They were knuckle walkers. And, okay, it kind of walks upright, but what does this prove? It's a 100% ape. And upright means you got apes that walk a little bit upright, like chickens, and sometimes you got lizards that do, and this is not proving anything regarding evolution. What does uprightness demonstrate? There was an interesting observation in Israel at the zoo there. One of the workers at the zoo say that's when she started walking upright exclusively. Here's the monkey that was sick. It got the flu along with several others, and several of them died. But this one survived, and after it recovered, it walked upright all the time. why is this? A zoo veterinarian says he's not sure why she's altered her behavior, speculating that illness could have caused brain damage. So maybe that's why we walk upright. But it doesn't prove anything regarding evolution. Regarding Australopithecus, as you'll see in the quotations from the handout, she walked like an ape, as Zillman said, the knuckle walker, had a brain the size of an ape, and had teeth like the Galata baboon, not like all apes, but like some apes, and then arms like an ape, way much, much longer than ours, proportionately, and had hands like an ape, long fingers that wrapped around branches, and legs like an ape, little short legs, feet like an ape, could grasp the branches, and toes like an ape. What do you think it was? Must have been a duck. You know, the Australopithecus was an ape, and not really a challenge when you look at all of the evidence. Now, you can whittle on the bones and try to make it otherwise, but that just gets to be embarrassing as you get more evidence. The next up the line is Homo erectus, and historically, this is where the story begins. Darwin had predicted that somewhere you'd find an ape more human-like, a human more ape-like, and everybody, a lot of them went out trying to find that. And they had the Piltdown man that is being examined here by the leading authorities there at Cambridge University. There's Black and Dawkins and the ones that were the real authorities in the field. And they wouldn't let anybody else see it. Lewis Leakey was there at Cambridge at the time. He was really incensed that he wasn't allowed. He wasn't in the in crowd. But it was a fraud. I don't think most of them knew it at the time. They didn't want to know it. They didn't want to see it that way. It was ape and human filed down and stained and put together to look like the ape man that Darwin had predicted, which has, of course, after 40 years of being taught in the textbook, been exposed. But notice the observation by Roger Lewin, who is editor of Research News, the friend of the Leakeys, in his book, Bones of Contention. And by the way, the book is not a bad book. He, of course, believes in evolution and the billions of years, but historically, he does a good job of recounting what's happened. How is it that trained men, the greatest experts of their day, could look at a set of modern human bones and see, in the fragments, and see a clear simian signature? Now, it wasn't there, but they saw it and believed it. And see in an ape's jaw, and that's what it was, the signs of humanity, unmistakable signs. The answer inevitably have to do with the scientist's expectations and the effects on the interpretation of the data. As someone said, if I hadn't believed it, I wouldn't have seen it. And that's exactly what we see illustrated here. They believed it, and so they saw it. We'll just quickly run through this. If you want more information, we have the DVD on fossil men that examines each of these. The Java man used to be 500,000 years old. Now he got shrunk down to 27,000, which is almost nothing, evolutionary speaking. According to Richard Leakey, was a University of Minnesota, form of Homo sapien. He's the leading expert on Java man. Turkana boy Leakey is the expert. Large, unnoticed in a crowd, just like humans. The 1470 skull dated 2.8 million, way back at the beginning of the bottom of that ladder, like modern humans, according to Mary Leakey. And then the little toy footprints that are supposed to have been made by Lucy are people not unlike ourselves, according to Mary Leakey. Canopy man, 4.4 million, that's older than anything else they got. Indistinguishable from modern, according to the head of the graduate school at UCLA. And that's from the multivariate analysis where they measure the bones, about 1,000 different measurements, different ways, and then put it in the computer and let the computer say it's similar or it isn't, rather than just eyeballing it. Indistinguishable from modern humans. What do you think we got here? These are people that we see in the fossil record. And then we come to Neanderthal. Everybody's heard of them. This critter is not very human looking, is he? You meet that in the back alley and you turn around and run. Spooky looking. But that's the way it's been restored. Others who restore reach very different conclusions. You can model either the philosopher or the chimpanzee, you recall. Trinicus is probably the recognized authority in the world, certainly in the United States, but most would say knows more about Neanderthal than anybody in the world, and he's really aggravated a lot of them because of some of the things he said. And here, quoting in Live Science 2008, he says he has not seen evidence of any kind of difference, either biological or social, between humans and Neanderthals. Did you know the leading authority in the world has said that? I can't find any difference. They're people. We look at people like this. This is from the Russian wrestling team. And yeah, different maybe from most Europeans, and you superimpose the Neanderthal skull, and wow, that fits just right, doesn't it? And you look around, and here is Jerry Stackhouse, who used to be in Dallas. He's now with the Hawks in Atlanta. It fits just precisely, but you model with different assumptions, you come up with different conclusions, but with exactly the same validity. Interesting observation recently, the image of Neanderthals may be in need of a makeover. Scientists say at least some of these extinct hominids could have had a fair skin and red hair from the DNA. Fair skin, red, have you all seen them drawn that way? No. What would they look like with fair skin and red hair? It fits just perfectly. But with different assumptions. And then we have learned fairly recently, according to BBC News, that they use cosmetics. And then the professor there at Bristol University says to me, it's the smoking gun that kills the argument once and for all. It buries this view of Neanderthals as halfwits. And it's not buried with all, but it should be. Neanderthal, according to Richard Leakey, was unquestionably Homo sapien. It was a ridiculous reconstruction that Buell made, who was going to find evidence of Darwinism. And that was a quotation from Howells, who was head of the anthropology department at Harvard. He got the ankle bones on backwards, this hunched over thing we looked at a while ago. He said, by all laws of physics, he should have fallen on his face. At Mount Carmel in Israel, we find Neanderthal bones and human bones in the same cave, except the modern bones are underneath the Neanderthal. Modern is earlier. Human language, they spoke like we did. They had a large, did you know they had a larger brain than you did? Pea brain? Much bigger, well, 1600 cc's compared to about 1440 that we have. Significantly larger brain. They were religious. They buried their dead with religious ceremony. They were musical. They played flutes. They had exactly the same do re mi scale that we have today. I've listened to the music that you can make, and it sounds just like our music. What do you think these were? It depends on who's doing the reconstructing. I think these were good people. And so we've got men, and we've got apes, and then, of course, modern men. But this is not evidence of evolution. We got men and apes today, don't we? Let me summarize it this way. Looking at the proposed ancestors, you look at the zoo and you see apes. And they're not all the same, are they? There's a wide variety of them. Now, you might line them up as you might imagine an evolutionary scenario, but they're all alive today. There were more alive in the past because we have seen a deterioration of diversity. It has gone downhill, and that's what that cone of diversity that Gould has in his book says. We started with more. We've got less today than we had. And some of the ones in the past are extinct, and they fit this picture but made it a bigger picture, but that's not proof of anything except that we had different kinds of apes that are now extinct. On the other hand, we have a significant variety of humans that look maybe different from you and what you're used to looking at. A significant variety, but they're good people, they're humans. And some of them may look a little strange, but it depends on who's doing the looking, doesn't it? But that's what we're seeing. We see apes and we see men. We see a variety of each, but there's no problem seeing the difference between the two. It's one or the other. Or as Stephen Gould used to, I'm sorry, as Dwayne Gish used to say, you either get the apes or the humans, or you get a little Incus Opus and a little Hocus Pocus, and you come up with Pithecan Spoofus. And that's what they've tried to put in the middle, and there's no good evidence for it. When you look at the evidence of fossil men, I think you see unquestionable evidence that it favors creation. Good men, good apes, and in between, a lot of foolishness, which is exactly the thing that we saw when we looked at the fossil record. They're distinct and they're separate. They were that way at the beginning of the fossil record, and all of the supposed links, I think all of them have been debunked. Certainly they would acknowledge almost all of them when they should be in every stratum, according to Darwin himself. There's tremendous evidence in favor of the fossil record. Now, without the fossils, you remember, it's an outrageous hypothesis. I think they're without them. They belong to us. I think this is a record of judgment. As we look at the mile and a half of sedimentary rock that we've considered this week, laid down by water that covers all the continents rapidly, we see evidence of judgment. It has billions and billions of dead things in it. Lots of fossils died. Why? Well, you may laugh and joke about sin. God doesn't. We see evidence of God's attitude toward sin. He judges sin. That's the way Peter used the flood. It is to demonstrate the fact that, you know, you say God doesn't judge, you know, things continue as they were since the beginning. You're forgetting something. You willfully ignore God did judge. And that's what we see in the flood. Sin is serious. Billions and billions of fossils testify to that. They don't testify to evolution. They testify against it and to the fact that we are lost without God's mercy. If you're here this evening and haven't obeyed the gospel of Christ, God's mercy is extended, but it won't be extended forever. He will judge if you don't avail yourself of His mercy. We're all guilty. And we need to submit to His will. Come confessing your faith, repenting of your sins, and being baptized into Christ. If you've done that and wandered away, your faith has waned, come back. Make those things right through confession and prayer while we stand together and sing.